It's thought of to be a parody of knighthood. Well, you may not have read Don Quixote, apparently a number of you have, but you most certainly have heard one of the greatest of Broadway show tunes, The Impossible Dream. The Impossible Dream is a very inspirational song, and it's been covered from the time of its introduction in 1965 by dozens, maybe hundreds of artists. I've listened to a lot of them on iTunes, and everyone that I listen to, every version is very good. There's some changes in some of the lyrics, but it's a brief song, but it was part of one of the great Broadway musicals, which is based on Don Quixote. Man of La Mancha came out in Broadway in 1965. It was a musical, and then it was turned into a movie in 1972, starring Peter O'Toole, Sophia Loren, and James Coco. Had a great cast. So you may not have read the book, but you've heard the very inspiring song, which is almost antithetical to the parody of what Cervantes was going to, because it turns out to be a very inspirational song that people absolutely love and are inspired by, and that was the aim of the authors. In last week's sermon titled The D-Day for God's Church, I referenced the two C's that all Christians must have: courage and confidence. But how do we acquire the kind of courage and confidence the church must have to complete its mission, that of preaching the gospel to the world? This sermon will address that need. Don Quixote may have been a spoof poking fun at the romanticized notion of knighthood, but the music that came from the adaptation of the book had a different effect. The song The Impossible Dream is certainly one of the most inspirational show tunes of all time, and that was during an age, the time of the 60s, and when there were a lot of great musicals that came out of Broadway, maybe the golden age of musicals and great show tunes. The Impossible Dream is, as I mentioned, one of the most covered, that is, sung by many different artists, of all Broadway show tunes. And, you know, as I said, I've listened to a lot of them, and they're great, because if you have a decent voice, the song is so great, it's really hard to mess up if you're a good singer. The writers of the song, Joe Darian and Mitch Lee, were inspired by the idea, get this, of never giving up one's aspirations, no matter how daunting they appear. So they crafted The Impossible Dream to convey the message of unwavering determination and dedication. I'd like to read to you the lyrics, and you'll remember them: to dream the impossible dream, to fight the unbeatable foe, to bear with unbearable sorrow, to run where the brave dare not go, to right the unrightable wrong, to love pure and chaste from afar, to try when your arms are too weary, to reach the unreachable star. This is my quest, to follow that star, no matter how hopeless, no matter how far, to fight for the right without question or pause, to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause. And I know if I'll only be true to this glorious quest, that my heart will be peaceful and calm when I'm laid to my rest. And the world will be better for this, that one man scorned and covered with scars still strove with his last ounce of courage to reach the unreachable star. This is my quest, to follow that star, no matter how hopeless, no matter how far, to fight for the right without question or pause, to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause. And I know if I'll only be true to this glorious quest, that my heart will lie peaceful and calm when I'm laid to my rest. And the world will be better for this, that one man scorned and covered with scars still strove with his last ounce of courage to reach the unreachable star. Now, I think the song is a perfect complement to parts of Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews 11, verses 13 through 16, first of all, says that these all died in the faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. They seek, in a sense, the unreachable star. When the author of Hebrews, I think Paul, but maybe not, we don't know necessarily, but I think I'll just say Paul. When Paul wrote about these heroic figures in Hebrews chapter 11, he wrote that they did bear unbearable sorrow. They did run where the brave dare not go. They were scorned and covered with scars. They were willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause. I hope that doesn't offend anybody, that language. And going on in verse 15, we read, "And truly, if they had called to mind the country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them." If you saw the movie Man from La Mancha, or maybe had opportunity to hear about or watch the original Broadway play, even though it was Don Quixote is a figure that is quizzical and kind of driven mad, you still can see the parallel between a Christian life and what God calls his people to do. He calls us to have courage and confidence. And as Mr. Horchak mentioned, yes, we have mentioned in the last 5 years that the world has changed greatly. It's changed faster than any time in my life, and I'm 71. It's changed so quickly, and again, not for the better. We should be aware as Christians as to what is happening. This last line of verse 16 is really meaningful, isn't it? God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. That means that all sacrifices that the people of God who are called of him and who have courage and confidence, who feel like they should right the unrightable wrong, that they should bear unbearable sorrow, that he is not ashamed of them. He's proud of them. He's proud of you. In verse 36, we'll drop down to Hebrews 11 and verse 36. It says, "Still others had trial of mockings and scourgings, and God allowed it. Of chains and imprisonment, and God allowed that. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were tempted. They were slain with a sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth, and all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us." That is so majestic and beautiful, that is what we have to look forward to, and that we have these faithful individuals who've gone before us and set the pace. We're all in this together with them, aren't we? People that lived thousands of years ago, maybe in some cases decades ago, because those individuals have passed on into the kind of the same template as Hebrews 11. We're all in this together with them, those that dared to trust God, those who put their lives on the line for the sake of the gospel message. In short, they dreamed the possible dream, which is the title of the sermon today. The possible dream. Can we as well? The answer is yes, if we have the right formula and training and commitment ourselves. Let's note 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 3. I know that sometimes because we're in a church, because we're part of the church, and we feel like we trace our historical antecedents back to the New Jerusalem church that began on Pentecost in 31 AD. I know that sometimes Christians can shy away from the idea that they're being recruited for warfare, but that's exactly what you've been called to. And you have to be a warrior, and you have to be aggressive in the right way, and you have to be confident, and you have to have courage. In 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 3, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, they're not physical, but they're mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ." The war begins with us at first. I think we understand that. We understand that God's Spirit enables us to adjust ourselves. It's a monitor on the individual behaviors and attitudes of the human being right here. So I speak to myself, I speak to all of you regarding this, that is where the warfare begins first, but it doesn't end there. And a Christian must be outward in their involvement. And again, the world is turning more and more evil. Time is short for this world, and that spells out the reality that our time of preparation is also short. So we need to understand that. One of the keys that I think we understand, and this is truth that was revealed to the Church of God maybe close to 100 years ago, and other people throughout history have understood it, but understanding who the Bible describes as Israel. That's kind of an important thing. You would think that it's an important thing to understand who Israel is, understand where they came from, because the Bible is a book about Israel. It's based on Israel. They're just other nations come into play, but the Bible is a book about physical Israel and then spiritual Israel. So if you don't know who physical Israel is, and you don't know who spiritual Israel is, and you don't know where they are in the world today, then you're really at a disadvantage. You can learn a lot about the Bible, and the Bible speaks about a lot about love and the Ten Commandments and all of that. But a critical key to understanding the Bible and your place in the world and your role in the world is understanding who Israel is. And we basically boil it down. We've got booklets on it, of course, but boil it all down. You find the English-speaking nations of the world are in a special place, and they have been in a special place, but now they are under attack. All of them are under attack, and they've been the beacons of freedom throughout the post-World War II era. And now those nations are under attack. So that's a one key in understanding who those people are, because if you don't have that, it doesn't mean you can't be a good person. It doesn't mean you can't understand a little bit about the Bible. It just means that your education is going to be greatly limited. That's a fear that I have for the people of God in the Church of God today. Now, I could probably go off on a riff as to why I feel that way, but it's unfortunate. That is one of the fundamental truths that helped guide my way and path into Christianity. No, that's not the most important. It comes down to personal behavior and understanding who you are and that you're responsible for the death of Christ and all of that, right? And that Jesus Christ is our Passover and understanding forgiveness and salvation and all of that. But once you get past that, there are other important things as well, and that is a real key. Because if you can't follow that, you cannot follow the thread of Bible history and prophecy. Because the Bible is a book about the history of Israel and the prophecies of Israel. And if you're going to be informed and alerted about what's happening in the world and why it's happening, you're going to have to know those things. You can't ignore them. But foremost, the Bible is a book about spiritual Israel. And the fact that God is grafting everyone into a spiritual relationship, and that he will, and we learn that through the keeping of the holy days. Now let's turn over to 2 Peter chapter 3, because I think that if we haven't gotten this stage yet, We will soon. And maybe we arrived there long ago, because sometimes it's hard to pinpoint when prophecy occurs. But 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 3 says, "Knowing this first, that scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lusts, and saying, where is the promise of his coming?" Which goes back to the first point that I made about who Israel is, because the Bible also gives many warnings about the time of Jacob's trouble, the time of Israel's problem, the time of Israel's decline in the world. And if you don't understand that Jesus Christ comes back on the Feast of Trumpets, that's what has happened through history. People have lost the information and the understanding. It even goes back to 1844 and the Great Disappointment. The Great Disappointment, in which someone had figured out that Jesus Christ, based on their errant understanding of Daniel, should return in 1844. And when that didn't happen, that entire group of people lost the knowledge and forgot the knowledge of Bible prophecy. But I think that this is more specifically a prophecy regarding the time of the end. And that, you know, you can kind of get misled a little bit when you understand that Christ said that the time of his coming will be like the times of Noah. And people have thought, oh, wow, you know, people are going to be marrying or giving in marriage and everything. Things are going to seem normal. No. No, they're not. The times of Noah were some of the most violent times on the face of the earth. The times of Noah were so corrupt and so decadent and so murderous that God had to send a flood to destroy the world at that particular time. So it wasn't life as usual, wasn't life as normal. The times of Noah, if the time of the end is like the times of Noah, it means that it's going to be very, very difficult. Oh, sure, there will be weddings, there will be marriages, and that part of life goes on. But nothing will be normal, and nothing is normal, and nothing has been normal, as referenced by Mr. Horchak, in the last 4 or 5 years in the world today. So it's time to be on guard. It's time, as the people of God and God's church, since we're experiencing societal change at such a rapid pace, yet at this particular time, my working theory is that this nation and the other English-speaking nations of the world, not to say others haven't been blessed, but they have been blessed very abundantly from 1900 on, 1800 on, incredible blessings showered the richest nations of the face of the earth. And a rising tide lifts all boats, so the rest of the world has also been made wealthy, except for the undeveloped third world in many cases. But we have experienced so much in terms of blessing, and that the changes that are happening within the modern nations of Israel are great, but we have retained our blessing. And because people are continually blessed, some are oblivious to what is happening in the society around them. To complete the mission that we have been given, which is preaching the gospel to the world, we need courage and confidence. We've also got to be alert that things are not as they seem, and that the problems that we have experienced, maybe not individually and personally, oh sure, everybody pays a little bit more at the gas pump now, everybody pays a little bit more for their groceries, or maybe a lot more as the case may be, and inflation is ravaging our nation. Yet, we're still here, have a great place to meet. But it could all fall apart very, very quickly. It's so fragile, whether we're talking about the societal fabric that we live within, whether we're talking about the economic situation that we're living in, it could all come crashing down very, very quickly. So I think most of you are aware of that. I think most of you are very keen about all of that. But let's get back to our dream. The dream that is paralleled by the sacrifice and the work of those of Hebrews 11. It is like Don Quixote's vision, which was somewhat misguided. It is noble and it is heroic. And yes, we are marching with a heavenly cause, and that is the way that we will complete that mission. Let's turn to Ephesians chapter 6. And we will stay basically for the rest of the time today in Hebrews chapter 6 towards the end of the chapter, because this is where courage and confidence are built. And I think I'm going to introduce some ideas that maybe you haven't considered before. I know that in hearing a lot of different messages about this particular passage of Paul's writings, I guess I'd come to some conclusions about them. I think that maybe I'll challenge some of my own conclusions today as well in looking at that. Just minor things, just little touch-up things. But this is where courage and confidence that I spoke about last week that the Church of God needs, and you as an individual need, and I need, this is where it is built. This is where it begins. We'll begin in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 10, where Paul says, "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and the power of his might." That's where it comes from, and it's good to recognize the source. It's not coming from within. It's not just internal determination as it was on the part of Don Quixote and his flailing around at windmills and supposing that they were giants or problems and imagining difficulties that he would try to spring people out of and rescuing people who didn't necessarily need to be rescued, but in his imagination, they did. Our goal, our vision, our dream is indeed inspirational. It's not impossible either. It's the possible dream. Verse 11 says, "Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil," which is another topic we'll be covering. Put on the whole armor of God. I'm going to ask you to hold your place if you're turning, but if you're just watching the screen, which I think is incredibly convenient, we'll come back to Ephesians chapter 6. I'm going to read to you from 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 7, where Paul also invokes this theme. "By the word of truth, by the power of God, by the armor of righteousness on the right hand and on the left." So both hands. The armament takes place in both arms. The entire body is covered and the head is covered. And we'll get into that. But it's maybe represents something a little bit different than what you might have thought of in the past. It certainly, when I restudied this, it certainly challenged me to kind of re-understand or rethink my former opinions. God intends his people to be armed both left and right. Armed, not just protected, but armed as well. The whole armor is a complete system, and we'll find in a couple of other passages that it's not just our armor. This is God's armor as well. It's what he wears, so to speak, from a symbolic standpoint. Note Isaiah chapter 11 and verse 5. Before we go back to Ephesians 6, Isaiah 11 and verse 5, it says, "Righteousness shall be the belt of his loins, and faithfulness the belt of his waist." And then in Isaiah chapter 59 and verse 17, "For he put on righteousness as a breastplate." This is what God wears. He wears righteousness, and it is like a breastplate and a helmet of salvation on his head. "He put on the garments of vengeance for clothing and was clad with zeal as a cloak." That's kind of comforting. God is offering you the same armor that he wears. Now, it's symbolic, right? We're not talking about literal metal and chainmail and all that kind of stuff. It's symbolic, but this is what is the protective aspect of the armor of God. The equipment enables the soldier to ward off attacks of the enemy and make a stand against him. You'll notice that stand and withstand are mentioned a number of times in Ephesians chapter 6, a total of four times, and some have concluded that the battle of a Christian engages in is kind of a defensive posture. But I do not believe that to be true. I believe that a Christian must be on the offensive. I've got Stan Braumuller is watching, was a former professional soccer player. And as you may know, some of you that are soccer fans, not too many, but there are several large soccer tournaments going on in Europe and in America. They're kind of a coordinated effort. And I guess it's not a World Cup year. I don't pay that much attention. But when it comes down to it, no matter what the sport is, you have to score. Now, sometimes they don't. Like, they've had a couple of scoreless ties, and they have to, but somebody's got to put the ball in the net sometime through penalty kicks or whatever. In the same way, a Christian has to be on the offensive. Sometimes I had concluded that, wait a minute, all this stuff is just protective armor and we're not supposed to do anything. No, make no doubt about it. We have to score. You have to score. This is for there to be victory in a battle, you have to be on the offensive. You can't just be on the defensive. I talked last week about the stand that the 2nd Battalion made on Pointe du Hoc. They made a stand. They held their ground. They held that high ground. They took it from the Germans and they held it, but then they went on the advance as well. And that advance took them through Europe to Germany to defeat. You can't just stand still. Yeah, you can stand and you can defend and you can defend your ground, but a Christian must move forward as well. My father-in-law was a policeman, many of you know. He also ran a college security at campus in Big Sandy for many years. But he had been a highway patrolman. He was well-trained in guns. He was an expert marksman. He finished for the peace officers in the state of Texas, for the Texas Parks and Wildlife. He finished number one on several occasions out of hundreds of officers that they had in the park system there. He was great. His father was great. He was an excellent. So what I'm saying is Lee was incredible. He knew guns. He was safe around guns. He was, you know, some people get freaked out. They see a gun, blah, blah, blah. Not my father-in-law, not Terry's grandfather either, who was like, and it shot shooting expeditions in the 1920s. Just a quick story. He shot with a nationally famous marksman who was employed by the Remington Corporation, and they did shootings around San Antonio, and they would shoot 22 rifles, and how good were they? Well, they could take a washer, you know what a washer is, a metal washer, they could take a washer, a small washer, and then shoot at it and move it across the sky just by shooting at it and making it move. Now, that sounds incredibly impossible to most people. I said, no, I don't believe that, no way. Well, you can look up the records, but at 80 years old, we went hunting in Central Texas, and Terry's grandfather hadn't shot a 22 in a long time. And he looked at me and he said, Stevie, do you want to see me hit an ejected shell out of the air? I said, what are you talking about? He says, well, I'll shoot up in the air, I'll eject the shell, and then I'll shoot and hit that. I said, you can do that? He says, watch this. And he did it. I mean, I heard the ping right after he shot. So all of that just sets the stage that safety, all of that sort of thing in terms of shooting and guns and all that sort of thing, they were all familiar with it. We were at Terry's dad's house a few years ago visiting, and Lee had a 22 rifle by the door. You know, he had guns at various places, I mean, just for safety, and he was used to them. He was a police officer. I said, is that gun loaded? What a stupid question. Wouldn't do much good if it wasn't loaded, if you need it. The gun was there for protection in case needed. Now, people that are gun nuts don't understand that. I mean, they're anti-gun nuts. They don't understand that. But at any rate, I'm sure that's none of you. My greater point is that God has given his people weapons of warfare, the same ones that he wears. They do protect, Some are meant to be protective, of course, but they're definitely not just defensive in nature. I think some have concluded that we don't, as Christians, go on the offense, but we must. We must get the goal in the net. We must move forward. We must advance. That is part of the offense. The whole armor of God helps protect us. They help us establish our position. They help us stand our ground from which we launch an attack, from which we preach the gospel. Now let's go back to Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 12, because this certainly is not a defensive posture that a Christian takes. Ephesians 6 and verse 12, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places." What is Paul talking about? He's talking about Satan and the demonic realm over which they do have control of this earth. Not in heaven. The heavenly places is a little bit further defined in chapter 2. It's the air around us. Now, they don't exist in the air and the physical elements of the air, but Satan is called the prince of the power of the air, right? And that's part of the heavens around us, and that's where they abide. That's where they're here. They're marooned on this earth. And so we are battling and wrestling against these forces. And you know what? Before any of you ever came to the church, you never knew they existed. Or they existed in some strange, non-biblical way in your mind, that where you maybe knew about the devil. And I remember when I first came to the church, I asked my mother what she knew about the devil. And she said, well, she said, "The main thing I know about the devil is that he doesn't want anybody else to know that he exists. And a lot of people don't think he exists because that's the way he feels." And I thought, wow, that's what he wants us to think. Wrestling is not done just to hold on. And we're wrestling against these powers. It's fighting to win, and defeat is not acceptable. And defeat won't be a part of the equation as long as you put on the whole armor of God. Good triumphs over evil every time. It's not just a trite saying. The principalities, the powers, the rulers of spiritual darkness are evil and wicked, and they are afraid of righteousness. They're afraid of Jesus Christ and God the Father, and they fear them. You are their emissaries, God the Father and Jesus Christ. And they fear the Creator God, and they fear His Son. The heavenly places they inhabit are not the spiritual realm of God's third heavens, but this earth. That's where the battle is taking place for the people of God. In Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 13, again, Paul says, "Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand," to position yourself, to protect yourself, from which you launch an offense. "Stand therefore, having girded your waist with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness," the belt of truth. This represents living in truth and integrity and being a person of your word, being a person of integrity, just as God is, protecting your vital chest area with righteous living. Yes, we are saved by the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, and we can't save ourselves. We need that sacrifice. But after that, we are responsible for our own obedience to God. Verse 15 says, "And having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace." You lose that, you lose everything, don't you? Because moving forward with the gospel of peace is like the Roman armies, and like Alexander's armies and the Roman armies were, one of the things they were good at was having good footwear, at least for the times. Probably be very uncomfortable for us. But they can move at amazing speeds because they did take care of their soldiers' feet. And that is what God's people need to have, shod our feet with the preparation of the gospel. So preaching the gospel is definitely not a defensive posture. It's courageous. In fact, it opens up opens you up to a lot of criticism. It opens you up to a lot of contempt from this world and from the demonic forces and realm of this world. But it is a powerful statement and affirmation of the truth and the justice that is going to come to this earth. We read in Isaiah 52 and verse 7, I think Paul quotes this in Romans. Isaiah 52 and verse 7, how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news. Now, the mountains are representative of governments, and I fully believe and expect that among the governments of this world, the gospel will be preached again, because I believe it was preached among the nations. It didn't take well. I mean, it was preached. It was given to heads of state. The information was given in language that they could understand, but it certainly was given. I mean, I'd never been told this story. Ellis LaRavia had never told me this story, but the night he went into the hospital, before he passed, we talked for a long time, and he told me about spending 4 hours with Princess Diana while Mr. Armstrong was with Prince Charles, explaining to him his entire history and background, and telling him things that he probably had never heard about before, but he just sat there and listened. Now, it obviously didn't take. Didn't take, but that doesn't matter because the message was given to him. But how beautiful upon the mountains or governments are the feet of him who brings good news, who proclaims peace, who brings glad tidings of good things, who proclaims salvation. This is the gospel message, brethren, who say to Zion, your God reigns. That's kind of what I'm doing now. Zion is symbolic of the church. God reigns. His message reigns supreme. And going back to Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 16, above all, taking a shield of faith with which you'll be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. The fact that a shield is needed is proof that a Christian isn't engaged solely for a defensive posture. Needing a shield shows that the people of God are moving forward. They're taking those fiery darts. They're not shrinking back from those fiery darts, but moving forward despite them. Now, there were arrows and there were projectiles that were used in ancient times that were tipped with tar, something that could be lit, and they would start fires in a village. They would set an entire town ablaze. But the Christian must repel them with the shield of faith. And the type of shield Paul referred to here was probably not one of the round shields you've seen in some of the old movies, you know, about Roman soldiers or Greek soldiers or Egyptian soldiers or whatever. It was more or less an oblong or rectangular shape, about 4 feet long and 2.5 feet wide. So the fight or the battle wasn't, it was real. They were protecting their heads with a helmet. They were protecting the rest of the body with a long shield. It deflects the fiery missiles, and then it also renders them ineffective. Now, what are we talking about with the fiery darts of the wicked? Sometimes that takes the form of gossip. Sometimes that takes the form of false information. Sometimes that takes the form of innuendo or problems or creating problems, even sometimes within the faith, within the body of Christ. But the shield of faith renders these flames, quenches them, keeps them from spreading. In Ephesians 6 and verse 17, and take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. Now from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary, we read, the head of the soldier was among the principal parts to be defended, as on it the deadliest strokes might fall. You can imagine if somebody rained a sword down on your skull, I mean, pretty much kill you. You've probably seen some of the movies in which that is depicted as kind of gory. That kind of close combat was dirty, messy, and hideous. The principal parts to be defended as one on it the deadliest strokes might fall, and it is the head that commands the whole body. The head is the seat of the mind, which then has laid hold of what the sure gospel hope of eternal life will not receive false doctrine or give way to Satan's temptations to despair. God, by this hope, lifts up the head. Now, the helmet of salvation protects a Christian, but then there's also a weapon that a Christian has, and that's the sword. The sword a Roman soldier kept was a two-edged sword, as Hebrews 4 and verse 12 indicates. And the first place that that offensive weapon is used is actually on us. You have to fight against yourself and your own human nature, your own carnal nature. You have to turn it on yourself in the right way, not to kill, but to help. The word of God is living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the division of soul and spirit and of joints and of marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and the intents of the heart. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, the two-edged sword cutting both ways, striking some with conviction and conversion and others with condemnation, is in the mouth of Christ and in the hands of his saints. They've got several scriptural references that show that and prove that. I don't have time to just isolate those. Moving on to Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 18, Paul begins summing up the conclusion of putting on the whole armor of God by saying, praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, being watchful to this end with all perseverance and supplication for all the saints. That is something that I believe the people of God do a very good job of, being concerned for one another, praying for one another, reaching out for one another, and praying not only for the effectiveness of the gospel message, but praying that God would work with every single individual and protect all of us. Being watchful to this end with all perseverance and supplication for all the saints, and for me, that utterance may be given to me, that I may open my mouth boldly to make known the mystery of the gospel. We don't have Paul around to pray for, but we have the ministry of Jesus Christ. We have, let's face it, we have various groups that do a very good job in the Church of God in proclaiming the gospel. We should be united with them and praying for them as well. Why God has allowed us to be separate, it's something that is kind of a mystery, but we may never all be under one banner, but that doesn't mean we can't pray for every individual to be effective. There's really no competition here. There shouldn't be any competition. There should be cooperation. To that end, I was informed yesterday that a great servant of God, Dick Ames, died at age 88. And he was a wonderful individual, a wonderful minister in the Living Church of God. And he had been one of my instructors in Ambassador College for a year. He visited here the first year we came to the feast in Tucson when we were assigned here in 1988. He and his wife, Catherine, were a lovely couple, wonderful people, and our hearts go out to them and all of their members as well. They were, he was a very, very dedicated and very converted man of God, I would say. We look forward to meeting him in the resurrection. You'll note that there's no armor for the back. Once again, this shows the offensive nature of Christian warfare, if you will. We do not need to be afraid of the enemy. You know, you'll see a lot of promos for horror movies and everything that have demonic influence in them. I'm sure it's very great and it can be very scary. But a Christian needs to have courage and confidence that none of that can touch them or their lives, in which God will not act on your behalf. Ephesians 6 gives us an outline for the courage and confidence that we need in the end times. Now, I know that many have noticed a change in the events over the world of the last 5 years and wonder, what can we do to prepare? And during the time of shutdowns, people losing jobs over various things and mandates and whatnot, people wondered, what are we going to do to survive? And a lot of people think normally about physical preparation. And I agree with the sentiment that you should probably take a little stock right now of and an inventory of what you have going on in your own household. And maybe make sure you have a little extra food. And maybe make sure you have a little extra drinking water. And maybe make sure that you can do some of those things that can help you withstand some of the onslaught of inflation and everything. But you're not going to hear any doomsday prepper message from me. I mean, people that get into that stuff, that's fine. But that's not your ultimate salvation. And you can, you know, have some storable food at home. I've got some. Have, you know, maybe a little extra cash, you know, so that if banks shut down or whatever. I mean, all of those things can be good, but that's not your salvation. That's not your preparation for spiritual warfare. You do a little bit of that stuff, and home gardening is great. I mean, I salute people that can do those things. Try to do a little bit of it myself. But people wonder, what can you do? Get your nose into the Bible. Understand what it means to be a warrior, a Christian warrior. Understand what it means to put on the whole armor of God, because Ephesians 6 gives us the outline for courage and confidence. In last week's sermon, I mentioned that the Allied forces, including my father, who was part of a great division, was, again, I still haven't figured out how somebody from New York State got into a Ranger battalion that was centered in Maryland and Virginia, but somehow he made it there. And they had a motto, 29, let's go. That was their motto for their entire history. It goes back to the Revolutionary War. 29, let's go. And my father recalled one of their generals or lieutenant colonels on the beaches of Omaha that said, there are two kinds of men on this beach, the dead and the ones that are going to be moving forward, let's go. And he invoked the motto of the 29th Division. So many have noticed a change in the events of the world over the last 5 years and wonder, what can we do to prepare? Maybe do a little physical preparation, that's good. But brethren, there is no better starting place for this. We are in a glorious quest. We have been given a noble objective. We are preceded by many others in the faith, and their example inspires us to see God's plan to the finish. We have the possible dream.